I'm going to adopt a defensive strategy slightly different from that of the other philosophers. I'm mostly going to raise a question, and then you can fight each other about the answer. So here's my stipulation. For present purposes, emergent means plays no role in fundamental descriptions, but figures in approximative descriptions underwritten by fundamental physics. So if you think there is no such thing as the fundamental level or something, that's fine. This becomes a relational notion, right? Relative to this, if you consider this to be relatively fundamental, then this thing is relatively emergent. Okay, so many string theorists say that space-time is emergent. Space-time geometry and topology in particular are emergent in this sense. And I just want to understand better how the argument, one of the arguments that's given in support of that claim works. So my strategy is going to be to like give the gist of the argument, especially for the benefit of my philosopher colleagues, and then sort of outline another argument that will be more familiar to philosophers than physicists for the emergence of space-time topology or the non-objectivity of space-time topology or something like that. And then, I mean, the basic plot is going to be, I think, physicists tend to find the first argument, the argument given by string theorists, like, looks pretty good. Philosophers aren't so sure. When it comes to the other argument, I think everybody will agree it's kind of terrible. The arguments are parallel in certain respects, and so my way of trying to learn more about the first argument is by getting people to tell me what they think the salient differences are between the two arguments. Okay, so let's start by talking about dualities, because the string theoretic argument is an argument from dualities. So, you know, a duality is something like you've got a theory here, and you've got some kind of operation you can perform on it that gives you a new theory, and you perform it twice, you get back to the original one. And in some sense, the operation preserves everything you care about, where what you care about is going to vary from context to context. So the greatest and the best duality of all is the duality in projective geometry between lines and points, right? So if you write down the axioms for projective geometry, you find that if you take the axioms and everywhere switch the words point and line, what you get are theorems of projective geometry. And that's telling you that any theorem of projective geometry that you've proven that has points playing certain roles and lines playing certain other roles, you get a new theorem by just switching the words everywhere. It's also telling you that it's sort of hard to know if someone says, I've got a projective plane here. There's something sort of funny about saying these things are the points and these things are the lines, because you could equally well think of them as having their roles swapped. Okay, that's sort of a warm-up. A duality, like maybe the oldest and the best duality in physics is electromagnetic duality, so it's on the handout there. If you've got vacuum Maxwell theory, you've got a solution with the electric and magnetic field, you can make a new solution by switching E and B, right, and putting a minus sign in front of one of them. It doesn't work if you have sources, but for vacuum Maxwell theory, it works, unless you put in magnetic monopoles. So there's an operation, right? You're like, I've got Maxwell's theory. I make this new theory that's basically the same theory, but I switch the roles of the fields, right? I do that operation twice. I get back to where I started, duality. Okay, here's the first one that's going to have the flavor of what we want to talk about. Most basic kind of so-called T-duality. So say your space-time M is a cylinder. Right. Space and time. And you're going to make a nice linear field theory that lives on the cylinder. And it's sort of a scalar field theory, but the field takes its values in a circle, right, rather than on a line. So you've got this map, X, that takes points from, what do we want? Right. A point ST in space-time is mapped to a point X on a circle. So here's the circle that's the target space. right? So that's a nice classical field theory. We don't need to go through the details. Here are some physical quantities that are of interest, though. You can have, you know, imagine a constant field over here, right? So it's taking you just to one point, right? Physically, that's going to be the same as the constant field that takes you to some other point, right? I mean, no interesting physical differences between those two. And there's a symmetry. There's a symmetry map that takes you from, you know, this constant field to that constant field. And so there's a generator of that symmetry, the target space momentum. Right? So there's a physical quantity, and, you know, we know it by its deeds. Its deed is it gives you a field, and if you operate it on it, it gives you a field that's just the same, except with the zero point shifted, basically. Target space momentum. There's another interesting physical quantity, the winding number. So consider, say, as I go around space once, I go around the circle once in the target space. That's interesting, right? Winding number one. I could equally, as I go around space once, go around the target space twice. Or I could go around almost three times and come back, right? Both of those would be winding number two. So that's a sort of topological thing that's counting how many times you've gone around the target space as you went around physical space once. Two interesting physical quantities. When we make the quantum field theory corresponding to this classical field theory, what we get is a Hilbert space that's a direct sum of a bunch of harmonic operator Hilbert spaces. And the sectors are labeled by these conserved quantities, winding number and target space momentum. Both of them are integers, say. Okay. Now, what's interesting here is I make my field theory for that target space, its circumference r. Right? Then I make my field theory for target space with circumference 1 over r. Right? So same kind of field theory. The only difference is how big is the target space. Right? The theories aren't the same. In particular, you know, the target space momentum won't have the same spectrum as in the first theory. But there is a duality transformation that maps you from the Hilbert space for this quantum field theory to the Hilbert space for this quantum field theory, namely the one that maps R to 1 over R and swaps the roles of winding number and target space momentum. Okay, so that's the simplest form of T-duality. T stands for torus officially, but here it could stand for target space. Right? We have basically the same physics in these two field theories, radius R here, radius 1 over R there. Other values of the size of the target space would make differences that would show up in the spectra or whatever, but this one, no differences show up as long as, in addition to placing R by 1 over R everywhere, you also remember to swap these two observables. Okay, that's the simplest form of T-duality. Fancier form. Now, we've got a string world sheet, right? So, it's the world tube of a string, and it's being embedded in some horrible space-time M. Right? And the physics is the physics of the geometry that gets induced on the string world sheet by the embedding. Consider another theory where we're embedding in some other space-time W. Say M and W differ by having one dimension that's rolled up in a circle, and in one case, it's a circle of radius r, in the other case, it's a circle of radius 1 over r. Then we'll find, if we're careful, that we can make a string theory here that's dual to the string theory there. For instance, in the sense that the partition functions are the same. But in some other, in many other senses, the physics is the same between the two theories. That's the first, like, interesting form of T-duality for string theory. Super fancy form, right? Mirror symmetry. There's a conjecture that it's a generalization of T-duality. In this case, M and W are wildly different, right? Different geometry, different topology. Same physics, if you're careful in the way you set things up. Okay, so good, duality. So here's the argument from duality for the emergence of space-time, geometry and topology. So this is from a lecture of Seiberg's. Consider strings propagating in some background fields, e.g., the space-time metric, amongst others. Then it turns out that different backgrounds lead to the same physics without any observable difference between them. Therefore, there is no unique answer to the question, what is the background metric? And the background geometry is ambiguous. And he might have said the same thing about topology, right, using exactly the same argument. Okay, so I take it this is one of the many reasons that string theorists have for thinking that space-time is going to be emergent once everything gets settled. Yeah?
The hard point is that once everything gets settled,
yeah.
There's a conjecture that there is a formulation of string theory that makes no reference to any embeddings in any manifold, and that these embeddings in manifolds appear as characterizations of classical solutions, and were that the case, I think there would be a strong case to say that it was classical. That's different from the thing that you've made, which is that string theory is defined via an embedding,
yep.
Which is necessary to specify before the theory is defined, and it just happens to be that there are some pairs of embeddings that have a relationship of a symmetry, not a gauge symmetry, but a symmetry that is a map from physical equivalent to one to the other. That's
yep. Right, agreed. But it seems like the latter is often taken as one of the many motivations for believing the former, right?
There's a difference between motivation and evidence.
Okay. I think that's true. I'm not sure that everybody who writes about this would agree. Well, you know, so maybe in theory, I think everyone would agree. I think in practice, sometimes people sin against this conviction. But let me press on. okay, so here's this argument, right? So, I mean, obviously, how things are going to go in the next 50 or 500 years is going to be what really settles whether we think space-time geometry and topology are emergent or not. My question is just like, if we freeze things right now and look at the kinds of reasons that some people are giving right now for thinking that space-time topology and space-time geometry are emergent, what should we make of the reasons? Okay, so consider the following golden oldie. Let's talk about space. So, I mean, obviously, I could have a space-time where space was a torus, right? And I could have, here's just a section of time. So there's Guy Lafleur, right, recording his disco hit. All you got to do is try, try, try. Happens just once, right? Now here's the a closely related space-time, obviously, is the covering space-time where you unroll the torus and make infinitely many copies of it, right? Now its space is going to be Euclidean space, and you're going to have infinitely many copies of Guy Lafleur recording his disco hit. Right? Okay, totally elementary. Now, Hans Reichenbach, one of my great heroes, thought that this was a clear case of a situation where there was no objective fact of the matter when we consider these two possibilities about which one is true. There aren't really, he thinks, two different physical situations we could think about here. There's only one. And so space-time topology must be not objective. Okay, so here are two sorts of reasons that were given in sort of the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s for thinking that this must be right. One was verificationism. So the idea is like, if you've got two sentences and anything that would count as evidence in favor of one would also count as evidence in favor of the other one, or anything that would conclusively verify one would conclusively verify the other, or whatever, you can make the other brands of this, then the two statements really say the same thing, So it's a statement. It's a claim about meaning and language. Right? If you believe that, then it looks like you should say, yeah, we didn't manage to describe two different possibilities here because the sentences that we used always had the same meaning as one another. Right? Because no measurement we could make would rule out the torus but leave in the other one. Okay, so that's one possibility. Another possibility, more in the spirit of Henri Poincaré, is conventionalism. In order for a statement to have a determinate content, we have to settle on criteria of application. So in our case, the same reality would be described equally well as involving circular time or as involving recurrence. Okay, so I switched the example, but toroidal space-time topology or open topology. In one case, you know, we'd have infinitely many copies of Guy Lafleur, and in the other case, we just have one. But that's sort of up for us to decide. There's reality sitting there, there's how we describe it. There's two different ways of describing the same underlying reality. Neither of them hooks on better than the other, right? And so the best thing to say is, until we come along and like settle on what we're gonna put in the textbooks, right? It doesn't even make sense to ask the question which one's right. Once we settle on a convention, we're like, no, there could only ever be one Guy Lafleur, right? That seems like a good principle. He's so fantastic. You know, then we're gonna think, oh, well, it turns out space-time has to be toroidal. Okay, so reactions that the philosophers will be having, right, is verificationism turns out to be very, very difficult to make work. As a theory about language, it appears that it's not gonna go. And conventionalism, I mean, it sounds very good, right? Of course, there are different ways we could have used our words, and so they would have meant different things. That sounds good, right? Everybody's going to agree to that, but the consequence is going to be, you know, any move you make using conventionalism could be made about anything, right? And it's not interesting to say, you know, is it really a piece of furniture? I could have called it something else, right? The person who's trying to make this point about reality not really having an objective topology is trying to make some kind of deeper point. And that's only going to work if there's something very special about the case at hand, right? That makes it very hard for us to pick out these two alternatives. But it seems so easy, right, to say, look, there's just an objective fact of the matter about how many Guy Lafleurs there are, right? It doesn't seem like we have any trouble, you know, distinguishing between those two hypotheses, that there's only one copy of this great man, or there are infinitely many. Yeah?
So I'm living in a universe that copies of me individually set, and every one of me encounters
this stuff. Yeah, if you're lucky, yeah. Yeah, that's right. If you're lucky, then all of you encounter Guy Lafleur. And if you're unlucky like me, you've never met him, then... No, I mean one overall. I mean, it seems like the kind of thing... I mean, think about yourself, if you like. I mean, you know, how many copies, how many things are there exactly like me are there in the universe, right? Now, that I don't know how many things there are exactly like you in the universe, you know. But I think I say, like, you know... You know, multiple choice, A, just one, B, infinitely many, C, none of the above. I think there's got to be a right answer to that multiple choice question. It seems worrying, very surprising, if there's some kind of problem with the language we use to write the question that made it impossible for us to say what the answer was before we settled these questions about geometry.
I don't want to bore you up. One of me encountering one of these things.
Well, I don't think they are. I don't think they are both the same. But that's what the conventionalist about space-time topology has to say, based on, you know, even this very simple example.
Your example, the copies are completely non-interrupt.
Yeah.
That's what. I mean, you can never encounter anything.
Well, you can, of course, you can move from cell to cell. There's nothing stopping that. It's just all copies of you are all... So there's Guy Lafleur. He's at rest, right? But here's me. I'm, like, going... from cell to cell searching for Guy Lafleur, that's fine. I mean, it's not like there's something funny about the boundaries between the cells.
There's only about 5 minutes left to your talk. Maybe you should finish it and we'll have 5 more minutes of discussion.
Is it a quick one?
It seems like a good moment to get down to the
indiscernible. Yes. That was a quick one. I agree. Okay. Let's come back to it, though. So So this is a funny, this kind of version only comes up because of a symmetry thing that you might be dubious about. That's very true. Okay, so, I mean, because philosophers have been marched through this history any number of times, right, in their education and so on, they have this kind of thing in mind when someone says, look, I've got these two theories, and they make the same predictions, so they must not. There must be no difference between them. So, you know, any apparent physical difference that they're latching onto is imaginary. So, forget it, right? And so, when they hear this argument from duality, they often think, "Well, it's a little quick, right? I don't think I want to go along with this just on that basis because it seems like there could really be a difference. You know, why not just say there's two field theories?" One where the target space is like that, and one where it's like that. Of course, we couldn't tell the difference, but that's okay. We're sort of used to thinking, in philosophy these days, we sort of relish in coming up with cases where the evidence isn't going to help us to decide which is which. And for the most part, we think it's fine. Now, physicists are, in general, much less thrilled to find things like that. And clearly, I mean, I'm going to say, I think there are definitely some of this difference is rooted in straight facts about sociology. And my argument for that is going to be, in philosophy, our intuitions about what's acceptable and what's unacceptable has undergone a tremendous change in the last 50 years, and I expect it to change and start changing in the other direction. I mean, I don't think, in philosophy at least, I could say that the way we're brought up and the kinds of examples we're exposed to and the order in which we're exposed to them makes no difference. Let me finish and come back to that. Okay. I'm going to finish in a minute. So, but I think there's also something more interesting going on here. So, the reason why I wanted to present this case is because I think if you think for the, I think it should make philosophers feel kind of funny to say, oh, there's really two different options here. And the reason is, you know, you imagine, you know, we get to this theory by constructing it out of the classical theory, and we sort of feel like, oh, that's a target space, and that's a target space. I sort of have a feeling for what that means, blah, blah, blah. Target space momentum, it makes you feel like, oh, I know what momentum is, and this is just momentum in the target space, and so on. Okay, but imagine you're just presented with the quantum theory, right? And you've got these two conserved quantities, call them L and M, that label the sectors. And they don't do anything except label the sectors. And switching them doesn't do anything as long as you switch this other number with its reciprocal. I think you should start to lose your grip on the idea that you know what the two options are that these two different theories could correspond to. Okay. And I think one of the reasons why at least some string theorists are happy to give the argument from duality is because they think about string theory in a sort of corresponding way. Rather than thinking of the strings as living in space-time, right, and this thing as being a sort of bookkeeping device that we use to keep track of the physical degrees of freedom, they think of string theory as a field theory that lives on a two-dimensional manifold. And these things, you know, as the sort of abstract things that correspond to the target space. Sometimes they'll say things like space-time and its metric are just like coupling constants that appear in the Lagrangian that are keeping track of the target space, and they're not to be thought of as the place where the strings live. So in some cases, at least, that's driving some string theorists towards their enthusiasm for the argument from duality. And one of the things I'm curious about is to what extent we're driven to thinking of string theory in that way rather than in the sort of very naive way that seems more comfortable of thinking of the string theories, the strings as living in space-time. All right, thank you.
Okay, yeah, so we'll take about 5 minutes or so of questions, but there will be a half-hour discussion at the end of all three talks of the morning, so there'll be opportunity to expound on that. And I'm supposed to repeat this tutorial of how to hold the microphone. So we're open for questions.
Can we start?
So
I'm afraid I missed the point.
Yeah.
So you were talking about arguments in favor of emergence.
Yep.
Your argument is that because there are things that seem not to be objective or they're conventional, this is an argument in favor of emergence?
It's an argument
because
in favor of...
I would say that emergence is quite objective. I mean, it's emergent, but it's objectively emerging in the limit of a large number of bodies.
So it's a... I mean, what it really is an argument for non-objectivity, but I've set up my definition of emergence to include that. Now, obviously, it's not closely related to several other kinds of emergence that have come up. For instance, because it has nothing to do with limits. I mean, in the string theory case, of course, there's supposed to be a story in the end, right, about how space-time does come out in the limit, but at this stage, nobody knows. Yes.
Yeah. So it seems to me, let me make a parenthetical point and then I think address your main point. Parenthetical point is if you want examples of quantum gravity theories where there's genuine emergence of classical space-time, mm-hmm. there are much better ones by this point. Like
yeah.
causal dynamical triangulations and spin foam models and so forth.
Agreed.
Okay. But I take your argument to be really an argument about the role of symmetry in physical theories. And so let me... You know, there is a case that might be made that whenever there is a state in a physical theory that has a symmetry, one should identify it, if there's a claim it's an exact description of the world, as spurious by virtue of the principle of sufficient reason. And that argument can be developed and, you know, in some sense is realized in general relativity where generic solutions have no symmetries and where there are no symmetries on the phase space or configuration space of general relativity. Any symmetry that emerges, like translation invariance of space or translation invariance in time, and I use the word emerge, is an accident of a special solution which is useful as an approximation but unphysical. So I think that there is an important role to play for ruling out as unphysical, as idealizations, as you know, unphysical models, solutions of theories that have symmetries that raise these issues. They're very instructive. They're very useful to teach us what the theories mean. But as a claim about nature, I think that there's a case to be made to rule them out.
Yeah, I agree. So, I mean, this is a sort of toy example that's easy to describe, but stands in for a whole family of possible examples, many of which involve symmetry and can be handled in the same way.
I mean, this one has a special problem which comes up in multi-universe context, which is as soon as there's an infinite number of stuff happening, the probability interpretation of quantum mechanics falls apart, as shown by Don Page.
Yeah.
As soon as you try to compute the probability that you might or might not encounter the musician, you find that there's a degeneracy because you have to give a meaning to an infinite number divided by an infinite number. Uh-huh. And the Born interpretation falls apart.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suspect that in a case this simple, there are actually ways to handle that, since, I mean, these two things are so closely related to one another that... but in general, I totally agree.
So let me, just to understand the... you mentioned at the beginning of your talk the symmetry between electric and magnetic fields. You
yep.
can get
yep.
you know, do the duality rotation there. So
yeah.
does that mean that electric and that Maxwell's electromagnetism is emergent?
So I mean I think this is a little bit of a puzzle for people. So I mean if for the people who are impressed by the right half. This stuff, right? Then you should think, okay, yeah. Look at the Maxwell duality case. I mean, it seems like what we should be looking for is some sort of way of representing things so that you know the field tensor and the thing that's related to it by duality correspond to the same thing, right? And then try to describe what that kind of reality is like. But of course, we don't care that much about this case, and we're lazy, so we're like. Even if, like Lee, we want to say there aren't two possibilities there, this solution and its dual solution, we probably won't spend a lot of time trying to figure out so, you know, how to give an intrinsic description of what's there that doesn't give you something at the level of tensors that you can act on by the duality transform. But I think, in principle, some people probably are committed to trying to find something, you know, they would approve of the project of trying to find something that's where you've stripped away that symmetry as a something that relates to distinct possibilities.
Right, it is actually a comment on the question you raised, Bob. I think there's a grand confusion when people refer to duality as emergence. A more sensational example is the idea of CFT. People usually say that, well, look, I mean, the geometry there, you know, is emergent because of this duality.
Yeah.
And I disagree with that completely. And in fact, there are string theories of two camps on this point.
Yeah.
Because if you can explain that both aspects, right, these dual aspects are emergent from a more fundamental theory, then I would count that as emergence.
Right.
Just looking at
something
at duality has nothing to do with emergence whatsoever,
yeah,
both in terms of processes or mechanisms, not even an underlying theory.
Good. Yes. And that's, I mean, so that's sounds to me like, yeah, the kind of thing I was trying to say to Bob, that I think if you're impressed by one of these dualities and you think, okay, yeah, there's no difference between this way of looking at things and that way of looking at things, you should be looking for the more fundamental description of which both of these are just different ways of representing or something. And if you could find that, then talking about emergence becomes appropriate.
Thank you.